Welcome to me droning on and on about John Masefield. I do this to anyone that'll listen, and even to those who won't. I even have friends who play a John Masefield drinking game in my presence. Good luck to you on Zoom. Masefield, for me, is one of the great and interesting writers of the 20th century. It's not that he's unpopular now. He's simply ignored. But dare to shun perceived current taste, and I believe Masefield has something to offer. There's a vast amount of poetry, novels, plays, children's books, and other writing to explore, and some of it is really good. Last year, we had the centenary of Eliot's The Wasteland and Joyce's Ulysses. This year is the centenary of Masefield's fat blue book of collected poems. The best seller was Masefield, not Eliot or Joyce. No, I'm not comparing Masefield to the giant innovators of modern literature, but I am saying there should be room for both. This evening is in five sections. An introduction, some dates and facts, a quick look at the poem Sea Fever, an enthusiastic consideration of The Box of Delights, and some sort of conclusion. So let's start by hearing the opinions of four canonical poets about John Masefield. Yeats said, "You'll be a popular poet, you'll be riding in your carriage and pass me in the gutter." Eliot said, "I think he is a poet of more historical importance than is usually put to his credit by writers of my generation and younger." Philip Larkin described Masefield as "a writer whose strength and simplicity I have long admired." And John Betjeman said that John Masefield wrote two lyrics which will be remembered as long as the language lasts. Something has gone wrong. Seriously wrong.
Visit your local bookshop, or even go online, and you cannot currently buy a new copy of Masefield's selected poems. It's being reprinted at the end of the year, but that's beside the point. Masefield published over 100 books. Only two are in print at the moment. Let's have a quick show of hands. Those of you online can pretend you're here in Ledbury. Who has read a novel by John Masefield? We've got probably about eight or so. Who has seen a play by John Masefield? Very small number, and I know what you saw. And who knows the poems Sea Fever and Cargoes? Now, for the benefit of those on Zoom, almost every hand has gone up. I've been reading and studying Masefield for almost 40 years. I've edited numerous editions of his works, published a number of books, and even got a PhD on him. So I have a perspective, valid or not, that I want to share with you. But before I start, let's get another perspective on Masefield's meteoric fall from grace. The journalist Russell Langstrom was present when someone during the Second World War asked the question, who would be the century's greatest man? The century's greatest man. Churchill, Roosevelt, and Gandhi were proposed. Then some bright spark suggested Masefield, with the explanation that the others will be long dead, but Masefield's poetry will still be alive. Langstrom illustrates this position with two anecdotes. He knew a taxi driver in Chicago who hadn't read a dozen good books in his life, yet he could quote several of Masefield's poems. And I particularly like this one. There was a cleaning lady in a London newspaper office. After a heavy air raid, she apparently commentated, "I was so frightened I almost wet me drawers, but I said to myself, look here, old girl, get hold of yourself. So I made another pot of tea and read a bit of me Masefield. He bucks me up, he does." Masefield was a best-selling author and, using a modern perspective, a perception of fame, a celebrity. Before we briefly look at his life and works, I'm aware that this lecture is part of Ledbury Poetry Festival's Dead Poet series. Nothing says dead poet as much as this. There are two aspects of this very simple gravestone in Westminster Abbey about which I'd like to talk briefly. Firstly, the Order of Merit, or OM. Masefield was appointed to the order in 1935. The Order of Merit has been described as, quite possibly, the most prestigious honour one can receive on planet Earth. Now, given a recent, rather notorious, honours list, let's discover what Masefield wrote about Order of Merits to an American friend in 1922. It must be said, of course, he wrote this over a decade before he was awarded the honour himself. He said, "An OM is an Order of Merit. Old Albert Edward instituted the order and made it very select for the very choice and the very famous and the very old. Barry is the only member under 70, and generally it is the last order you can receive before you die. It's the only order here which means anything at all. If you are any of the other orders, it may only mean that you have given good dinners enough to the right people, or subscribed enough to charity. But if you are an OM, it means that you are one of 12 picked souls, of which only about one at any time doesn't quite deserve it. And therefore it's about 11 to 1 that you are a real dog." Masefield was appointed late in his 50s, and it was an honour of which he was very proud. But his earlier achievement, and one which helps define him best, was his status as poet laureate. Not just any poet laureate, but the longest serving poet laureate after Tennyson. He served King George V, the VI, and Elizabeth II. What is a poet laureate, you ask? Well, we haven't time to examine this in any detail, but since 1668, when Charles II appointed John Dryden, there's been a poet within the royal household with the expectation, but not the requirement, that they would commemorate national occasions in verse. Some great poets have been appointed: Wordsworth, Tennyson, Betjeman, Hughes, but also William Whitehead, Thomas Warton, Henry James Pye, and Alfred Austin. In which camp does Masefield lie? Masefield was appointed by George V in May 1930. The news was widely applauded. A. E. Housman wrote to say that "the king has made the choice which I should have made myself." Bernard Shaw said the king could not have appointed a better man. And W. B. Yeats wrote to say, "the government has done well, and you will touch hearts nobody else could have touched. Your work will now take its proper rank, and those poems you read and sang to me in Woburn Buildings will be recognised for the classics that they are." I'd like very briefly to highlight Masefield as poet laureate as a supporter of other poets, an innovator, and as an author of some memorable, though forgotten, verse. One of Masefield's most memorable actions was to establish the Royal Medal for Poetry in 1933. Masefield explained, "Many years ago, some young writers held that the older writers were enemies standing in their way. The cause of poetry is served by all poets. The old are ever eager for young genius to appear and glad to welcome it." Masefield therefore established a medal that is awarded for excellence in poetry on the basis either of a body of work over several years or for an outstanding poetry collection issued during the year of the award. The poet must be from the UK or a Commonwealth realm, and the poems will have to have been published. Recipients have included W.H. Auden, Siegfried Sassoon, John Betjeman, Christopher Fry, Philip Larkin, and Simon Armitage. Masefield took his duties extremely seriously and devoted significant time to committee meetings and reading new books of verse. Now let's look at an extract from the Radio Times for May 1937 and the coronation of George VI. Look who's on the telly reading his verse. That's a poet laureate experimenting with new technology. As for the laureateship verse itself, it's quite variable. I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that when the Shakespeare Memorial Theatre opened in 1932, the first verse spoken on stage was not by Shakespeare, it was by Masefield. I'd also like to introduce you to a piece of verse which Masefield published in the Times on the 16th of November 1948, 2 days after the birth of Prince Charles. Yes, we still have a monarch about whom Masefield wrote laureateship verse. The resonant word here is service, somewhat changed over the years. No, it's not great verse, but it is heartfelt. A hope for the newly born. May destiny, allotting what befalls, grant to the newly born this saving grace, a guard more sure than ships and fortress walls, the loyal love and service of a race. I should say that when the late Queen died, I started posting examples of Masefield's laureateship verse on Instagram, and many people contacted me to say that they found the poetry still relevant. But I can't leave the subject of laureateship verse without mentioning John F. Kennedy. Masefield, as we'll shortly learn, had significant connections with the US. When he heard about the assassination, he was moved to write a simple but effective tribute. A commemorative record was issued in 1965, collecting together inspirational expressions following the death of President John F. Kennedy. The poem is read and introduced by the actor Cyril Richard, the actor known for his Captain Hook in the stage musical version of Peter Pan.
This is Cyril Richard. I feel particularly privileged to be able to speak the 46 words written by England's poet laureate, John Masefield. This poem was printed in the London Times, November 25th, 1963. It has a special and significant meaning, and I am sure the words will remain as immortal as President John F. Kennedy. All generous hearts lament the leader killed, the young chief with the smile, the radiant face, the winning way that turned a wondrous race into sublimer pathways leading on. Grant to us life, that though the man be gone, the promise of his spirit be fulfilled.
With reference to the Order of Merit and Poet Laureateship and Masefield's grave, I'm aware that I've properly killed him off. However, there are no dead poets. As we heard at the beginning, after Churchill, Roosevelt and Gandhi have been long dead, Masefield's poetry will still be alive. So let's bring Masefield's work back to life. Let's have a whirlwind biographical sketch and mention a few of the major works along the way. In 1912, Masefield published a poem called Biography. It started, "When I am buried, all my thoughts and acts will be reduced to lists of dates and facts." Also bear in mind a poem in 1936 entitled Sweet Friends. "Print not my life nor letters, put them by. When I am dead, let memory of me die. Blessed be those who in their mercy heed this heartfelt prayer of mine to Adam's seed. Blessed be they, but may a curse pursue all those who reject this living prayer and do." So let's risk the curse. If I'm struck down in the next few minutes, we'll know why. Masefield was born on the 1st of June, 1878, in Ledbury. His early childhood, he claimed, was one of paradise. For 6 years, Masefield enjoyed the idyllic surroundings of Ledbury. Then his mother died after a riding accident, and just 6 years later, his father died. The Masefield children, of whom there were six, were entrusted to the guardianship of a paternal uncle and his wife. Aunt Kate viewed Masefield's love of reading with suspicion. After a brief spell at Warwick School, he was packed off to the school ship HMS Conway. Aunt Kate hoping that the education would prepare Masefield for a career at sea and dispel his addiction to books. This is his school ship. His schooling introduced him to marine history, mythology, and yarns. Above all, he discovered that he had a gift as a storyteller. When Masefield left the Conway, he was apprenticed to a four-masted bark with a journey round Cape Horn. The new apprentice was violently seasick, and upon arrival in Chile, sunstroke combined with a nervous breakdown. Masefield was classified a DBS, or Distressed British Seaman, and returned to Ledbury. Aunt Kate, yes, let's see her again, taunted her nephew with failure, and arrangements were made for Masefield to join another ship, this time berthed in New York. Masefield had other plans, and upon arrival in America, he failed to report for duty, vowing he was going to be a writer, come what might. It was now 1895, and Masefield was only 16. He'd become a homeless vagrant, tramping the states for work. One theme throughout Masefield's work is his sympathy for the underdog. Masefield later wrote, "I look back on that knocking at strange doors, that period of sour welcome and curt turn down, with feelings I cannot express. Indiscriminate charity may be an evil. I dare say it is. Discriminate selfishness is, I guess, an evil rather greater. I don't think many tramps and vagabonds in their muddy, colourless minds dare a dull blasphemy for either. But what they do care for acutely, is the costless charity of the kind word, something to put a heart into them, to give them a rag of self-respect, and to make them feel more human beings than chivy dogs. He was saved from starvation when he was offered a job as an under-bartender in a New York bar. He never forgot his gratitude. When Masefield next visited New York in 1916, he sought out his old boss, and the second poem in his final collection of poetry, published in 1937, recalled, "One early summer, when times were bad, in little old New York, long ago, I looked for work, an ignorant lad knowing no craft, nor knowing how to know." Then he was offered a job in a carpet factory in Yonkers. The long hours were bearable because Sunday gave him an opportunity to read. He was advised by a local bookshop owner, and on the 6th of September, 1896, he first read some Chaucer. "I was taken into another world, unlike this in its excitement and beauty. It was a new experience. It seemed to me that evening that very likely there were no limits opened by such poetry. It seemed boundless in liberty, inexhaustible in riches, deathless in beauty, eternal in delight." His position at the carpet factory was precarious, however. Eventually, he had a row with his boss and threw up his job. It was time to return home. He later wrote to a close friend, "I landed in England with about £6 and a revolver. I was going to try and get a job as a clerk. I knew nothing of business. Failing that, I was going to shoot myself. I was desperately ill and sick. I hadn't the strength to face more hardships, so don't think me a dreadful quitter, but that was what I meant to do." Aged 19, Masefield became a bank clerk. He later explained, "For the next 2 or 3 years, I was almost continually ill, too ill at least to care for life, but working on at writing. I read hard every night and wrote much verse, all unhealthy, like myself." Then in 1899, he achieved a breakthrough. One of his poems was accepted for publication in a magazine, and within a year of publication, that poem was included in a book entitled Naval Songs and Other Songs and Ballads of Sea Life. Let's pause for a moment. Masefield had his first poem published in 1899. Queen Victoria was still on the throne. Only just. Masefield was a Victorian poet, and one who also commemorated the assassination of JFK in verse. But back to 1900. For Masefield, the time had come to pluck up courage and approach his literary hero. He was invited to dine with W.B. Yeats and was drawn into Yeats's circle of friends, including Lady Gregory, J.M. Singh, and Lawrence Binyon. Binyon was to be particularly influential on Masefield's life, for he introduced him to an Irish woman 11 and a half years his senior. When, in 1902, Masefield's first book was published, Saltwater Ballads, carried a dedication to three women. The first of these was the future Mrs. Constance Masefield. Incidentally, when Masefield brought Constance to Ledbury for the first time, Aunt Kate, remember her, nagged her, leading Masefield to report, "A viler and more damnable reception than Con could have couldn't have been meted out in hell to one of the worst of the lost." He also called Aunt Kate "that sour curse in Eve's flesh." Masefield married in 1903, and a daughter, Judith, was born in 1904. A son, Lewis, followed in 1910, when Constance Masefield was 43 years old. With the financial commitments of a family, Masefield pursued work as a literary hack. He worked for the Manchester Guardian, contributing a prodigious quantity of book reviews. Poetry didn't pay, and Masefield tried short stories, naval histories, novels, and drama. In 1907, his play The Camden Wonder caused some sensation and prompted Bernard Shaw to come to Masefield's defence. Then in 1908, his play The Tragedy of Nan was directed by Harley Granville Barker. This became a popular play. It was frequently revived, and there were a number of radio broadcasts, but none since 1968. The Orange Tree Theatre announced in 2007 that they would revive the play on stage, the first time in living memory that it had been seen in London. On the page, it doesn't look promising. Masefield adopts a country diction that could easily fail to work and looks a bit like Cold Comfort Farm. However, live in the theatre, I was shocked as Masefield's words revealed themselves to be effective and absorbing drama. For archival purposes, the Orange Tree Theatre allowed me to film the final dress rehearsal. This footage has never been seen in public. Let's join the action as Nan stands up to her cruel aunt and rails against her for purposely dropping Nan's coat in the pickswill. Now, in the published script, the aunt is simply named as Mrs. Pargeter. The manuscript drafts of the play name her as Kate Pargeter. Masefield had written of his own Aunt Kate that she had never said a kind word to any of us, but a brutal and cutting word, so many that they made our souls wither on their stalks. I hated that woman. There's no doubt that Nan, in this extract, channels Masefield's own emotions against Aunt Kate into a whirlwind of accusation and pathos.
And there was a girl. A young girl. A girl with a sick heart. Do you know what came to her? Yeah, you know what came to her. But she came among them as might have made much of her. Her heart was that broke, she'd have broke out a-crying of a kind word.
When you've done with your...
Don't you speak! Don't you threaten, you will listen to me! You had me in your power. And what was good in me, you sneered at. And what was sweet in me, you soured. And what was bright in me, you dulled. I was a fly caught in the spider's web, and the web came around me and around me till it was a shroud, till there was no more joy in the world, till my heart was as bitter as that ink and all choked.
Despite Masefield's creative efforts, he later described this period as a very real blackness of despair. He noted, "My work was not what I had hoped." Then in 1911, he published The Everlasting Mercy, a long narrative poem telling of the fighting and drunken debauchery of the fictional Saul Cain before a religious conversion. The setting, of course, is Ledbury. This evening, it's too good an opportunity to miss, so let's get Masefield himself to read a brief extract. Saul Cain has indulged in 3 hours of gin and smokes. In his intoxicated state, the devil whispers to him and a madness takes hold. Here, Saul shouts aloud to the sleepy inhabitants of Ledbury.
"That's what I'll do," I shouted loud. "I'll tell this sanctimonious crowd, this turn of window peeping, prying, maligning, peering, hinting, lying, male and female human blots, who would but damned be whores and sots, that they're so steeped in petty vice, that they're less excellent than lice, that they're so soaked in petty virtue, that touching one of them will dirt you with the stain of mean, cheating trade and going between, pinching, starving, scraping, hoarding, spying through the chinks of boarding to see if Sue, the prentice lean, has dared to touch the margarine, fawning, cringing, oiling boots, raging in the crowd's pursuits, flinging stones at all the Stevens, standing firm with all the evens, making hell for all the odd, all the lonely ones of God, those poor lonely ones who find dogs more mild than humankind."
In 1911, this was sensational stuff. Lord Alfred Douglas, of Oscar Wilde fame, branded the work 9/10 sheer filth. J.M. Barrie, however, called it incomparably the finest literature. One problem was Masefield's use of the word bloody. The English Review printed blank spaces rather than risk prosecution for printing the word. Joyce fans may like to know that the publisher Grant Richards, when he received Dubliners in 1905, encountered a very similar problem about the word bloody that he'd met 3 years previously with Masefield's Saltwater Ballads. And Robert Graves later claimed that Masefield's innovation in The Everlasting Mercy had emboldened George Bernard Shaw to make the word his dramatic climax in Pygmalion. Don't forget how irrelevant Masefield is today. The Everlasting Mercy has not been available in print since the late 1970s. Masefield had hit upon the long narrative poem as a new form. Remember his debt to Chaucer. The Widow in the By-Street and Dauber followed. Would anyone like to hazard a guess where The Widow in the By-Street might be set? With the outbreak of the First World War, Masefield was too old for military service. He volunteered as an orderly at a hospital in France. He then took charge of a motorboat ambulance at Gallipoli in 1915, and subsequently, he became a spy for the British government. The UK was desperate to have an accurate assessment of how America viewed the war. Masefield was therefore sent on a propaganda lecture tour and reported back to Britain's War Propaganda Bureau. Why Masefield? Well, who else had a wonderful understanding of the American psyche? Who else had experienced the hardships of homeless vagrancy in the late 1890s? I wonder, when Masefield visited his old boss Luke O'Connor in 1916, was it part of a publicity stunt? One pressing issue was how German propaganda was using the catastrophe of the Gallipoli campaign to their advantage. What was needed, Masefield suggested, was a work which would explain the Dardanelles campaign accurately, but also celebrate the glory of the defeat. Remember Masefield's sympathy for the underdog? One critic describes the historical work Gallipoli as a book to strike the critical faculty numb and a work too sacred for applause. Such was Masefield's success with military history that he received an invitation from Sir Douglas Haig to write the official chronicle of the Somme. Unfortunately, Whitehall bureaucracy forced Masefield to abandon his original plan, but there are two short volumes, The Old Front Line and The Battle of the Somme, which are well worth a read. And now for some shameless self-advertisement. In 2007, I collected all of Masefield's published work on the Great War as John Masefield's Great War. If you'd like to read how a poet dealt with the Great War in prose, may I recommend it. After the war, Masefield published another long narrative poem, Reynard the Fox. It's about a fox hunt, of course, but it's also Masefield's long narrative of the Great War. The novelist and critic L.A.G. Strong called it a masterpiece, and Muriel Spark described it as a great poem. Here again is an interesting insight into Masefield's popularity. In the 1950s, Reynard the Fox was an A-level set text. There were numerous BBC adaptations, including one where the reader was Michael Flanders of Flanders and Swan fame. Masefield released an LP of his own shortened version in 1960. In 1984, the wonderful Ronald Pickup broadcast a full two-hour reading on BBC Radio 3. And in 1985, Reynard made it onto stage in a Young Vic production. In 2008, I produced a new edition of the poem, returning to Masefield's original manuscript for an accurate text. If you leave the Burgage Hall this evening, again, sorry Zoom audience, you may well see the wire sculpture of Reynard crafted for a Ledbury in Bloom event. But Reynard has, unfortunately, come to another halt. When exhausted, my edition has not been reprinted. It sold okay, but there was no great demand for it. I'm proud of my edition, but I'm proudest of another Reynard project, and one that nobody knows anything about. Finding that the BBC had wiped their tapes of Ronald Pickup's 1984 broadcast, I eventually tracked down a good quality copy which somebody had recorded off the radio. This was all very well, but the person hadn't managed to get the entire broadcast on cassette. There were bits missing. I was fortunate to know Ronald Pickup slightly, and when I explained the problem, he generously offered to record the missing bits. I'd love to play you the full 2 hours, lovingly patched together by me, but we haven't the time. However, let's briefly join the hunt with an exhausted Reynard pursued by the pack and the fox placing all his hope in his nearby earth.
At the second attempt, he cleared the fence. He turned half right where the gorse was dense. He was leading hounds by a furlong clear. He was past his best, but his earth was near. He ran up gorse to the spring of the ramp, the steep green wall of the dead men's camp. He sidled up it and scampered down to the deep green ditch of the dead men's town. Within, as he reached that soft green turf, the wind blowing lonely moaned like surf. Desolate ramparts rose up steep on either side for the ghosts to keep. He raced the trench past the rabbit warren, close grown with moss, which the wind made barren. He passed the spring where the rushes spread, and there in the stones was his earth ahead. One last short burst upon failing feet. There life lay waiting, so sweet, rest in a darkness, balm for aches. The earth was stopped. It was barred with stakes.
Let's leave you hanging there and return to our dates and facts. The Masefield family was now resident on Boar's Hill, just outside Oxford. Neighbours included Robert Bridges, and Masefield, in attempting to help emerging talent, rented a cottage in his grounds to Robert Graves. Masefield also built a private theatre in his garden to avoid the Lord Chamberlain's censorship. I think it's obvious Masefield was rather successful in the 1920s and 30s. During these decades and the 1940s, Masefield had a fine run of successful novels. The Bird of Dawning, Dead Ned, Live and Kicking Ned. With the Second World War, there was more poetry. And, harking back to Gallipoli, Masefield wrote an account of Dunkirk, which ran into censorship problems. It was published as The 9 Days Wonder. Masefield's son was killed in the North African desert in 1942, and Masefield's serious ill health in the late 1940s and the early 1950s led to his fading presence. And yet, there were still surprising achievements. Masefield has always advocated spoken word as the best vehicle for poetry. In 1959, he released The Story of Ossian, an LP, which was the first time a major poet had first published his work in this medium. One reviewer suggested that, in a sense, this is the most important record ever issued in the history of the gramophone. Other records followed. Constance Masefield died in 1960, but Masefield lived on at Birkett Brook, just outside Oxford, adopting an increasingly reclusive lifestyle, though always accompanied by a cat. Towards the end, I understand that visitors would generally refuse the offer of a meal. One didn't know whether you were actually being offered cat food. But there was still poetry. The Bluebells and other verse, Old Rager and other verse, In Glad Thanksgiving. This is approximately, depending on how you count, Masefield's 39th and final volume of poetry. He died on the 12th of May, 1967, and his ashes were laid to rest in Poets' Corner, the last poet so interred. Robert Graves delivered his memorial address. He stated that Masefield had been his hero and that in him the fierce flame of poetry had truly burned. So much for our dead poet. I think that Masefield had, undoubtedly, something to offer his contemporaries. I've been working for several years on Masefield's letters without any hope of publication. His correspondence is fascinating and shows him as a link with many of the creative forces of the day. Who else connects Thomas Hardy, J.M. Singh, Jack B. Yeats, W.B. Yeats, Siegfried Sassoon, Rupert Brooke, Lawrence Binion, Walter de la Mare, Philip Larkin, T.S. Eliot, William Walton, Gustav Holst, Max Beerbohm, Arthur Ransom, George Bernard Shaw, Henry Wood. Let's return to Betjeman's comment. John Masefield wrote two lyrics which we remembered as long as the language lasts. Is Masefield's reputation really based on two poems, a mere six stanzas, and work published in 1902 and 1903. Masefield's final book was published in 1967. In other words, can we dismiss over six decades of his work? So, for the remainder of our time, let's look, albeit briefly, at a couple of Masefield favourites, the poem Sea Fever and the children's fantasy novel The Box of Delights. Sea Fever was first published in the periodical The Speaker on the 15th of March, 1902. It was collected for Masefield's first book, Saltwater Ballads, published in the November of that year. It soon established itself as a popular poem, aided, of course, by the setting by John Ireland. In 1962, Masefield released a record of his greatest hits. Using this as our source, let's get him to recite Sea Fever for us.
I must go down to the seas again, to the lonely sea and the sky, and all I ask is a tall ship and a star to steer her by, and the wheels kick and the wind's song and the white sails shaking, and a grey mist on the sea's face and a grey dawn breaking. I must go down to the seas again, for the call of the running tide is a wild call and a clear call that may not be denied. And all I ask is a windy day with the white clouds flying, and the flung spray and the blown spume and the seagulls crying. I must go down to the seas again, to the vagrant gypsy life, to the gull's way and the whale's way, where the wind's like a whetted knife. And all I ask is a merry yarn from a laughing fellow rover, and quiet sleep and a sweet dream when the long trick's over.
Who noticed the problem with the first line? Is it must down or must go down? It's first printed, as previously shown in Saltwater Ballads in 1902, as I must down. I must go down appears in 1910. This is also present in 1922. The original I must down reappears in 1923. And the additional go is back for the revised collected poems published as poems in 1946. What's going on? Well, when questioned in 1927 about the first line of the poem, Masefield replied, I notice that in the early edition, 1902, I print the line, I must down. That was as I wrote the line in the first instance. Somehow the word go seems to have crept in. When I am reciting the poem, I usually insert the word go. When the poem is spoken, I feel the need of the word. But in print, go is unnecessary and looks ill. In other words, Masefield identifies a difference between poetry on the printed page and spoken poetry. Poetry in performance is different from poetry which a reader requires off the page. But Masefield was somewhat misremembering the genesis of the poem. The working manuscript is in the New York Public Library, and may I just say the thrill of handling this is considerable. A single page of manuscript reveals two drafts, one in pencil and the other in ink. It's impossible to determine which is earlier, although the pencil version is the most likely candidate. The pencil draft reads, I must go down to the roads again, to the lonely sea and the sky, or I must go out on the roads again, to the lonely sea and the sky. The ink draft commences, I must down to the roads again, to the vagrant gypsy life. If we take nothing else away from this, we can discover that the poem is about a longing for an alternative life, whether it's life at sea or the life of a wanderer. That is why, in the published version, the vagrant gypsy life and a merry yarn from a laughing fellow rover creep in from earlier drafts. Ultimately, of course, the published poem is about the lure of the sea, but it's also about wanderlust and potentially about homeless vagrancy. We now know how personal this poem is. Written in 1902, it harks back to Masefield's experience as a vagrant. It's a poem about struggle, not belonging, and yearning for something different. And now, time for an enigma. Why and how did a middle-aged poet laureate, halfway through his career, create one of the most stunning and original fantasy novels for children ever written? There are two books, The Midnight Folk, published in 1927, and The Box of Delights, 1935, and I could talk about these books featuring the character of Kay Harker for weeks. L.A.G. Strong claimed that the books were amongst the most sure-footed and robust books for children ever written. The Times called them two of the greatest children's books ever written, and C.S. Lewis wrote that The Box of Delights was a unique work and will often be reread. The beauties, all the delights that keep on emerging from the box are so exquisite and quite unlike anything I have seen elsewhere. Long before the wizarding world of J.K. Rowling, there was The Box of Delights. Long before C.S. Lewis's Chronicles of Narnia, there was The Box of Delights. And a few years before The Hobbit, there was The Box of Delights. Box of Delights and The Midnight Folk are Masefield's lasting contribution to children's fantasy literature. Incidentally, I should point out that Aunt Kate died in 1927. 5 months after her death, she was immortalized for all time as a witch in The Midnight Folk. Masefield had his ultimate revenge. There'd been magical fantasies before Masefield, but in Masefield's Kay Harker books, children's literature entered a modern age of fantasy and ingenious invention. Of course, as with much fantasy literature, some people are captivated and some are left entirely cold. So what's it about? The young hero, Kay Harker, is entrusted with a magical device which enables the user to move swiftly and or reduce in size. The box also allows the user to enter magical worlds and travel into the past. The scheming wizard, Abner Brown, and his accomplices, disguised as clerics, wish to seize the box and start a systematic kidnapping, or scrobbling, of all who may have been trusted with keeping it safe. This involves the disappearance of a cathedral staff, and as Abner's evil plans escalate, the gang intends to stop the 1000th celebration of Christmas in the cathedral. The book is a surreal combination of ancient myths with 1930s gangsters. It's a fantasy in which settings include the Trojan War and a railway journey. It combines piratical rats with feisty children. It's set at Christmas with all the seasonal traditions and games one expects. It combines Romans on a wolf hunt and gangsters in flying cars kidnapping people. It sends up sensational newspaper journalism. And how can anyone forget Mariah Jones, who says, "Christmas ought to be brought up to date. It ought to have gangsters and aeroplanes and a lot of automatic pistols." The book's been illustrated by Judith Masefield, Faith Jakes, Quentin Blake, Syra Ogilvie, and Oliver Schrank. It's been translated into Spanish, Italian, Japanese, Persian, Vietnamese, and German. And crucially, it was adapted into a radio broadcast in 1943. This was an important moment for Masefield. The wonderful fantasy writer Alan Garner, remember the Weird Stone of Brisingamen, said, "The initial and strongest impact of The Box of Delights was the 1943 radio adaptation. For me, and for all of my contemporaries I've discussed the experience with, it's the radio production, not the book, that seared us. The book wasn't available." Alan is entirely right. The book was out of print by 1943. It wouldn't be reprinted until 1957. Radio was crucial in creating a magic in the absence of the book. Look at this small clipping from the Sunday Times from 1970 in the personal column. Somebody was desperate to join the Facebook boxers many decades before the internet existed. The same 1943 radio script was used again in 48 and 55. A new script was used in 1966. It was repeated in 68 and 69. There was another version in 74 and then 1977. The book had a loyal following on the radio, and in the late 1970s, the BBC asked if they might make a TV adaptation. Negotiations would take years before the BBC finally committed, at that time, the largest sum ever given to a children's serial. Let's enjoy the trailer for that adaptation.
"In my box are such delights."
Starting on Wednesday on BBC One, a new serial for children, The Box of Delights. The mysteries begin when young Kay Harker comes home at the end of term.
"Can I give you a hat?"
"Oh, if you would be so kind, hold me steady as I swing her up, then I can get her to my back, where she rides a triumph. Only I do date from pagan times, and age makes joints to creak."
"Do you keep dogs at Seekings, Mr. Harker?"
"How do you know my name and where I live?"
"Aha.
Magic?" "The wolves are running. Perhaps you would do something to stop their bite."
"If you see someone, say someone is safe. Look out for fun, Master Harker."
John Masefield's classic story brought vividly to life with a wealth of wizardry and devilish tricks. Patrick Troughton, Robert Stevens and James Grout star in The Box of Delights on Wednesday at 5 o'clock on BBC One.
Suddenly, there was new interest in John Masefield. Blue Peter even did a biographical feature on him, and this was featured in the Blue Peter Annual, of all things. It even appeared on the front cover of the Radio Times. Acting talent, including the magnificent team of Robert Stevens and Patricia Quinn. There was even a former Doctor Who in the person of Patrick Troughton. And some of the music, originally used in the radio adaptation, was skillfully reused. Unfortunately, and in a rather cruel twist, it was decided that 1980s children would be unable to cope with Masefield's original prose. The version of the novel that was published to tie in with the TV adaptation was abridged. Yes, when Masefield's big moment arrived, he was rather short-changed. In 1994, there was an amateur musical version, revived in the same year, and 1996 as well. In 1995, BBC Radio broadcast another adaptation, this time starring Donald Sinden, Lionel Jeffries, Celia Imrie, and Spike Milligan. In 2005, the unabridged audiobook version was released. In 2007, I started work on a new and editorially sound version of the text, returning to Masefield's manuscript. This was published in 2008 in both the UK and US, and the Folio Society used that text with a new series of illustrations in 2012. Then, in 2017, the book was adapted as a stage play by the brilliant Piers Tordé. This was such a success at Wilton's Music Hall in East London that it was revived the following year. Let's see some of their advertising video for the revival.
Go on, then. What does it do, this precious box?
Mr. Horning said if I pressed the lever to the right, I would go small, and I do. And if I pushed to the left, I would go swift.
Never mind the lever. What's inside?
He didn't say.
Well, go on. Maybe it's full of gold and diamonds to make our fortune.
I don't know. It's very precious and old.
Kay Harker, what is the point of having a box of delights if we can't delight in it?
Open the box.
Very well.
I do hope they haven't trapped a canary in there. The Animal Welfare League, they'll be onto us.
Look, it's opening itself.
The following year, there was a dance adaptation performed in the streets of Hereford by the innovative Two-Faced Dance Company. Their advertising trailer really doesn't do justice to the inventiveness of the evening, but here it is anyway. In 2021, there was a new audio adaptation released on CD and download by Big Finish, including Derek Jacobi in the cast. Being an audio adaptation didn't stop Big Finish releasing animated publicity trailers.
All aboard from Musbury Junction and stations beyond.
Canines go in the guard's van, sir. It's the
It's all right. My Barney dog knows the way. Tell me, young men, you haven't by any chance seen a pair of curates boarding this train, have you?
One thin, the other stout.
Yes, that'll be them.
Oh, they're up in first class, sir.
This train will depart in 1 minute. I repeat, 1 minute.
They found us, Barney dog. The wolves are running.
And, ladies and gentlemen, when Piers Torde emailed me to announce that the Royal Shakespeare Company were to present a new version of his adaptation of the play as their family Christmas entertainment in Stratford this year, I actually got goosebumps. Tickets are now on sale. What's my point about all of this? Well, Masefield was a prolific author, and as president of the Society of Authors, generally saw his role as a defender of high royalties and aggressive deals. When Penguin Books came knocking at his door to publish a volume of selected poetry, they weren't welcomed. There were Penguin editions of a few novels, but Masefield never fully embraced the paperback revolution. Film companies were also shunned. We missed out on Alexander Korda's treatment of The Bird of Dawning, Douglas Fairbanks, father and son, in Enslaved, Katharine Hepburn in The Witch, a version of his play Good Friday, starring Richard Burton, and Burgess Meredith, known to Batman fans as the Penguin, was also turned down. An Ealing Studios version of the novel Multitude and Solitude failed to materialise. I suggest that the public simply doesn't know about Masefield and his works anymore. Had these films been made, it'd have helped. It helped the Box of Delights. Yes, the only Masefield novel people now know is the one that was successfully adapted for radio and television. Are there other gems by Masefield waiting to be discovered? I think you know my answer to that one. But even the small things were passed over. In 1933, the firm of Cross and Blackwell asked if they might include a copy of Sea Fever in boxes of chocolate. Masefield's response was not simply to refuse permission. He told his agents, "Please prohibit utterly any such use of my poem." He sounds rather cross, no pun intended, and rather possessive of his work. One suspects that Branston Pickle wasn't exactly a favourite in the Masefield house. My point is, had people been eating chocolate and reading Masefield, it can't have harmed his reputation. The Box of Delights has a loyal following. Seek out the Boxers on Facebook. But there's more to Masefield. There's an active John Masefield Society. Look us up on Google. There are significant moves afoot in Ledbury to devise and implement a fitting memorial. And there's an RSC production to enjoy. But there are very few books in print. And his poetry is, generally, reduced to three stanzas of Sea Fever and three stanzas of Cargoes. But Masefield was an optimist. We ought to leave the last word to him, and the briefest of brief passages from his long narrative poem, King Cole. In the dark night of prison comes release. In the black midnight still the cock will crow. There is a help that the abandoned know deep in the heart that conquerors cannot feel. Abide in hope, the turning of the wheel. The luck will alter and the star will rise. Thank you. Thank you very much indeed. I'm aware that I'm really running to time, but if there are any questions out there, there's a microphone waiting here. No, good, right. We can all go home. Yes, sir.
You've made a splendid case for Masefield, but do you not find it problematic that his most famous line is, "I must go down to the sea again," and I believe I'm right in saying that he never did.
He did go down to the sea, and that he was a trained sailor. He was very bad as a sailor, and as I said, he was returned as a DBS. But he was certainly a sailor, very much so. Any others?
Philip, I thought that last extract was particularly interesting, and I'm sure that's why you chose it as the finale. A slightly different metre from much of his poetry, and it prompts me to say, did he actually experiment much with different metres?
There are differences to his poetry and experimentation. He did tend to stick to a certain pattern with the long narrative poems, and you could see that in Everlasting Mercy and Renard the Fox. But there is some experimentation. Yes, he's not an innovator. He's not going to be playing around in the way that the modernists did. Once he found something successful, he generally stuck to it. But in that, there's considerable craft as well. So, no, he didn't innovate with different forms, but he did try his hand at quite a number. Any others? Yes, sir.
It's just a very quick one, because you persuaded me as a newcomer to Masefield, really, that I need to read a lot more than I have done. All those films that you reference that have never been made, what's stopping them being made today?
That there is simply no interest. As I pointed out, there was huge interest in adapting Masefield, and when Masefield was alive, the point was that he would ask for bad deals that people wouldn't accept. There was going to be a film made of his novel Sard Harker. Sard Harker is an amazing novel. It's got a brilliant ending, and it whips itself into a frenzy. It would have made a wonderful film. And at a very early negotiation stage, Masefield starts talking to the film company about which sort of ship should be used in filming. And then he goes to the other extreme and says, you can't use this, you can't use that. They got frightened and said, well, if he's going to be like that, then what's stopping them being made today? The fact that there's no interest, no desire.
One last quick question from the audience online. Emma would like to know, for those who are not Masefield experts, where would be a good place to start with from his body of work?
I would say this, buy the selected poems when it comes out at the end of the year. The royalties will help. Otherwise, it's difficult. There is very little out there, although the second-hand book market, I would say that wearing an antiquarian book hat, can be swamped with editions. Choose your genre. If it's poetry, I would say Renard the Fox is a jolly good read. It may be too long for modern tastes, but it is particularly interesting when you view it as a great war poem. As far as novels are concerned, the adult novel that I go back to time and time again is Sard Harker. Notice the use of Harker there. Sard Harker, the hero in Boxed Delights and Midnight Folk is Kay Harker. Masefield sticks with certain names, and there are little obviously games that he plays with his readers. It's a very rewarding thing. Reading Masefield, you find names coming back to you, places coming back to you. So in answer to the question, where to start, pick a genre. If it's poetry, Renard the Fox. If it's novels, Sard Harker. And if it's plays, then probably Tragedy of Nan.
I come from Chipping Campden. And I knew there was a Masefield connection, but I didn't know what it was. Can you say a bit about The Camden Wonder, a play, you said?
The Camden Wonder is actually a historical text or a historical... there's this sort of trial that happens about the murder of someone, and people are hanged for the murder, and then after the hangings take place, the deceased comes back. So it's a tale that Masefield took and made into a drama. So that's where he uses a historical background but completely reinvents it. And at the time he did it, it was quite a shocking piece to put on the London stage. This is the point about Masefield. He was quite shocking. I showed you that picture of of his music room, it was called, but it's his garden theatre. That was built because he didn't have to listen to what the Lord Chamberlain wanted. You don't think of Masefield in that respect as an innovator, someone who's against censorship, but he absolutely was. Trying to depict Christ on stage, for example, was a big no-no. So we did it in a garden theatre. But Camden Wonder, it's the historical story. It's a good little piece, quite effective, quite shocking, reads quite well.
Another question from online, which follows on in many ways. Having witnessed huge advancements in the 19th and 20th centuries, would you consider Masefield a modern man?
I think he is a modern man. He did witness some huge changes, and yes, he didn't exactly embrace them, but then what's all this about making gramophone records? Nobody had done that at the point. So he did embrace new technologies, and he did try. So yes, I do think he is a modern man, and he has a lot to offer.
I'm afraid
we've run out of time.
We have run out of time, but that was absolutely brilliant and fascinating. Thank you very much indeed. I should also take this opportunity to thank both the John Masefield Society and Arts Council England for their support of Ledbury Poetry Festival. Also to alert anyone in the room who is not already a friend of Ledbury Poetry to the information about it. Please join us. You would be most welcome. Finally, my last very happy duty is to present you with this beautiful ceramic Ledbury Poetry Festival badge.
Thank you very much.
It's not all he's getting, I should say, but it is a small token of our very deep appreciation. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you.
Philip Harrington.